Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Welcome to ID the Future. This is Sarah Chaffee. On April 27th, Discovery Institute senior fellow and paleoentomologist Gunter Beckley described a newly discovered fossil dragonfly. He announced the organism in the ID peer-reviewed journal Biocomplexity and named the species after Michael Behe. Today, he joins us on ID the Future to share about this fossil. Welcome, Dr. Beckley.
Hello, Zara. Nice to join you.
Why is this an amazing specimen?
Well, first, one should mention that this fossil is about 191 million years old. It stems from the Jurassic coast of England, the coast of Dorset. And there is an interesting side note. This is the locality where in the first half of the 19th century, Mary Anning was active. She is one of the founders of modern paleontology and of systematic fossil collecting. And there was in 2008 an English edition of the German magazine Der Spiegel about this locality and about Mary Anning. And they had a subtitle, "What a girl named Mary Anning found there in the 1800s began to dismantle the Bible's account of creation and anticipated the theory of evolution." So there will be a little twist because this fossil also gives some evidence for intelligent design. But otherwise, it's not just a very beautifully preserved fossil and a new species. It's actually the best preserved, or at least one of the best preserved and most complete fossil dragonflies from the whole geological period of the early Jurassic. It's also relatively large for this era, so truly a remarkable fossil. It has perfectly preserved characters, not only of the wing venation, but also of the body, and that was important because the wing venation allowed an attribution to an extinct family, which is called Archaeopteridae. This family existed from the lower Jurassic to the lower Cretaceous, so between 191 to 130 million years ago in Europe and Asia. But they were only known by isolated wings, and this fossil has also preserved the body, including the terminal appendages and legs and the head with a lot of details, and so allowed for the first time to make a description of the complete animal and not just of an isolated hind wing or an isolated forewing. And finally, there was a special feature in the wing venation, which is absolutely unique. It was never found in any known species of the 6,500 species of fossil or recent damselflies and dragonflies. So it's a very unique find for several reasons.
So you've been involved in describing quite a number of species, over 160, and this sticks out?
Yes, definitely. It's not only for the quality of preservation, but also because of the scientific importance of this finding.
You named the genus for the owner of the fossil. Who did you name the species after and why?
Now, maybe one should mention that a scientist is basically free to name a new species as long as he follows the established international rules of nomenclature. So you could name it after a locality or the age or anatomical feature or a person. And I decided to name the new species after biochemist and ID theorist Michael Behe from Lehigh University, not only because he made groundbreaking contributions to intelligent design theory with his concept of irreducible complexity of molecular machines like the iconic bacterial flagellum, but also because, especially with his second book, he had a large influence on my own thinking, on my transition from neo-Darwinism to intelligent design, especially with his elaboration on the waiting time problem. And therefore, I decided to name this new species Michael Behe after him.
That seems fitting. So what particularly struck you when you read Edge of Evolution, Behe's second book, for the first time?
Now, what struck me was this mathematical argument which he made from malaria drug resistance, where he showed that if you transpose the empirical data from malaria, this much larger population size and much shorter generation term over time, if you transpose these numbers on vertebrates and make calculations, then you find that for a single coordinated mutation, you would have to wait in vertebrates for a time longer than the whole universe exists. So this is basically a mathematical refutation of the feasibility of the Neo-Darwinian process. And that was an argument which struck me as nearly insoluble for Darwinian theory of evolution.
What reactions have you received so far?
Now, there were a lot of positive reaction, of course, from the ID community. Also, the two people who were named, Chris Moore, the collector of the fossil, after whom I named the genus, and then Michael Behe, they liked the name, and there were a lot of positive reactions from ID supporters. But, of course, the other side is not so happy that Michael Behe was honored with their own species now named after him. Usually, they expect that only people like Sir David Attenborough is named after, new species are named after. And so there was a quite angry blog post by an anti-intelligent design blog called the Census Curmudgeon. And he tried to ridicule this whole stuff. And this, in a way, backfired, because if you look at the comment section of his blog posting, there were so totally incompetent comments that it shows that these people are not really interested in science and also have no special knowledge. So there was one guy, or I don't know if it's a guy, he has a pseudonym called Silurian Trilobite. He said, does the Linnaean Society accept taxonomic names from crank fake journals? So first, of course, only because he doesn't like biocomplexity as journal, it's not a crank or fake journal. It fulfills all requirements of the International Code of Zoological Nomenclature, and the Linnaean Society had nothing whatsoever to do with accepting taxonomic names. That's a totally ridiculous comment. And another commenter called Carl Goldsmith commented, surely it needs to be submitted to the Bulletin of Zoological Nomenclature to be recognized by the International Commission. That's again nonsense. New names don't have to be submitted. You only submit something to the Bulletin of Zoological Nomenclature if there are controversial cases where the same name has been used twice, and you have to decide which name is valid or which is not. And another commenter with a pseudonym, David Kay, said maybe they refer to Discovery Institute, can do some research and explain how this specimen was embedded in long ago amber. Well, that's easy to explain. It's not embedded in amber at all. It's a petrified fossil in stone. And two of the most ridiculous comments, one by James St. John, he said, a taxonomic revisor may be free to declare this fossil name a nomen nudum, ignore it and name it something else because it wasn't properly published, i.e. in a pseudoscientific rag. And this is again total nonsense. Nomen nudum is a technical term. This is a name that is published, a naked name without a description, which is of course not the case in this species, which has a very elaborate description, and there is all requirements of the international rules of nomenclature are fulfilled, so no taxonomic revisor is free to ignore this name. And the final thing, a commenter with a pseudonym DocBill1351 said, so dragonflyers Behe dumb bunny will be forever lost to obscurity, just like Behe. Fitting, I think, a forgotten unknown fossil of no relevance. Now, except for the vitriol, I think what is revealing is that this shows that these people are not interested in science. They make fun of a remarkable fossil which contributes to our knowledge of the fauna of the lower Jurassic only because they don't like the name. That is really ridiculous. And yeah, it tells a lot about the real motivation of people who make this kind of hate campaign against the things we do.
So it sounds like not very substantive complaints.
No, not a single one.
Do dragonflies fit neatly into the Darwinian story, or are they too a problem?
Like all groups of organisms, they pose their own problems for Darwinian evolution, and I would say there are at least four major problems related to the original dragonflies. One would be their abrupt appearance in the Carboniferous without any precursors, more or less fully formed, not modern dragonflies. You have these giant dragonflies in the Carboniferous, but they have fully formed wings with this whole wing articulation apparatus. There are some differences in the wing venation, but otherwise they are complete flying insects. Then there's a special structure in the aquatic larvae of dragonflies. They have a so-called prehensile mask. It's a kind of mouthpart structure that fulfills a function like the tongue of a chameleon. It can be thrust forward to catch prey. And it's very difficult to explain how this usual mouthpart apparatus of insect could be detached into this kind of prehensile structure. And we have larvae from these giant Carboniferous dragonflies from Mason Creek locality, from the upper Carboniferous of North America, and they already had this fully formed prehensile mask, again, without any precursors. Then there is this very strange mating behavior. Most people probably have seen mating dragonflies, which form this kind of heart-shaped mating wheel, which is the reason why in French they are called papillon d'amour, the love butterflies. And this mating behavior is related to a special copulatory apparatus in males. And the strange thing is that there are three suborders of recent dragonflies, the damselflies, the dragonflies, and the third group. They all have this apparatus. It's made up of the same parts. But the problem is in each of the three suborders, the functional, the organ that transfers the sperm and that removes sperm from previous copulations from other males, very sophisticated mating apparatus, is produced by a different part of this apparatus. So either internal copulation had to originate three times in parallel in these three suborders, fulfilling the same functions, or one structure was developed and then reduced to be replaced by another structure which fulfills the same function. It makes no sense in terms of an evolutionary scenario. So that poses a severe problem. And finally, you have a very high degree of so-called homoplasy, that is incongruent distribution of similarities of characters in dragonflies. So if you compare recent and fossil dragonflies, the pattern of similarity does not easily align with the hierarchical system required by evolutionary classification, which is a problem for Darwinian evolution, which is no problem for intelligent design.
And just for our listeners, you've been studying fossil dragonflies for how long?
Fossil dragonfly? Oh, since the mid-90s.
Is this particular fossil dragonfly primitive, you know, sort of a half-formed flyer?
No. This special dragonfly actually belongs to the so-called crown group of modern odonates. So it's not more primitive, or it would also, in phylogenetic terms, not be considered as a precursor or ancestor of modern dragonflies. It's actually closer to dragonflies than it is to damselflies. There is one character state in the forewing which would be considered as primitive, that is the so-called open discoidal cell, which is one cell which is not closed towards the base of the wing by a crosswing. But this character is again very homoplastic and does not align well with a simple evolutionary story. But one also has to say that the time from which this dragonfly originates from the lower Jurassic, evolutionists wouldn't expect to find, let's say, a half-formed flyer in this time. This would have to be expected, let's say, in the Carboniferous. And therefore, I think this rather relates to what I mentioned earlier, this abrupt appearance of dragonflies in the Carboniferous at the border between the lower and the upper Carboniferous, or what is now called the Pennsylvanian and Mississippian era, about 320 million years ago. And what you do not find is any kind of evolutionary transition between wingless insect and winged insects, or precursors of dragonflies, which have not this, let's say, this larva with only a partly detached prehensile mask, or with a more primitive set of wings, which were not already suited for perfect light or something like that. So, of course, many evolutionists and paleontologists would say, well, that's just a lack of knowledge, which is not really true. We have a very good fossil record meanwhile, so undersampling is a bad explanation. But there is another problem, that is, we know of, because you would basically have to claim that there are some strange evolutionary processes which could produce a transition in such a short time that you cannot find it in the fossil record, like Eldridge and Gould postulated in their punctuated equilibrium model. But something like this, if it would work at all, it would only work for minor changes on the level of microevolution between species, but not for major structures where you need major reconstructions or completely new body organs. We know of no possible naturalistic process that could produce something fundamentally new like the body plan of a dragonfly in such a short time that it would slip through the possibility of fossil record and you wouldn't find it because it originated so quickly that it just happened not to be recorded in the geological layers. So these abrupt appearances, as in the case of dragonflies, they cannot be explained with Darwinian evolution.
It's really quite a beautiful creature. You know, I'd encourage our listeners to go and check out the image and more discussion of the new fossil and of the over Beckley naming it after Michael Behe at Evolution News. Thank you, Dr. Beckley, for joining us on ID the Future.
Thank you for inviting me.
This has been Sarah Chaffee for ID the Future, and you can find out more about this fossil at evolutionnews.org. Thanks.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.